I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
Hashtag Clinton body count. Hashtag Trump's body count. Concern trolling over all the speculation. Conspiracy theories abound in the aftermath of wealthy sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's demise. Joining us on this edition of Parallax Views to discuss conspiracy theories moment in the mainstream is student of parapolitics, Gumby, who has recently gained quite the following on the social media website, Twitter. You can follow Gumby at twitter.com/GumbyForChrist. And yes, that name is taken from the beloved claymation character. Gumby has quite the sense of humor. He joins us to discuss how he became interested in conspiracy theories, or what some have called parapolitics, and has a very interesting personal story to tell. In addition, we also talk, of course, about the sordid saga of Jeffrey Epstein and other conspiracy theories, as the topic has really hit the mainstream, not only with Jeffrey Epstein, but also, a Netflix series like Wormwood, or Tom O'Neill's new book on the Manson family murders, Chaos. Oh, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention QAnon and Pizzagate, the latter of which we touch upon and critique in the following conversation. It's almost like conspiracy theory is the new hip thing. Now let's get straight to the conversation. Welcome to Parallax Views. Gumby, I guess it's just Gumby. You're a bit of a fixture on Twitter right now.
Well, I hope so, yeah. Gumby is good. You can call me Gumby.
Well, I wanted to have you on because, in the past week, over the weekend, I should say, it seems like parapolitics and conspiracy theory, as some would call it, has sort of hit the mainstream. It's become the hip thing. With the death of Jeffrey Epstein. I don't know if you want to maybe tell listeners about yourself, though, what you think of conspiracy theory, parapolitics, and how you got into this sort of thing.
Sure, yeah. So I agree with you. It's become kind of a weird... It, it's felt to me recently like it's the new fall trend or something that's been rolled out. Like, conspiracy is the new black. This is what we're all into right now. And I don't know exactly how that's happening, but it is interesting to watch it. So, I mean, my kind of entry into parapolitics, as you call it, or conspiracy or deep politics or however you want to frame it.
I was going to say real quick, some people get very, very angry with me when I say conspiracy theory. I had Joan Mellon on, who's done work on the Garrison case, and she does not like that word. You know, so some people get weird about that.
Well, I think a lot of people go back to that CIA document from the 60s where it was rolled out in a very concerted way that conspiracy theory was going to be the phrase that was used against the JFK assassination researchers. So I'm sure there's probably a sore spot there that it's essentially repeating what the CIA wants people to say. But I don't have a huge problem with it. I think maybe we should reclaim it or something. I don't have strong feelings on what this sort of thing should be called, I guess.
I like what my buddy Ken Thomas would always say. He's like, I don't like conspiracy theory. I like conspiracy fact.
Yes, exactly. Right. Because it is so easy to just theorize based on what could be. But, you know, there's an infinite number of possibilities of what could be. So it really is important to, you know, look at what is factually available, I think, you know. So my kind of entry into this stuff happened pretty much in 2012 when this very weird story came out that was pretty popular, that got a fair amount of attention here in St. Louis. And the story was that in the 50s and 60s, there were two separate programs. The U.S. military had conducted a secret, top secret experiment where they sprayed the population without anybody knowing with a substance. And the substance was zinc cadmium sulfide. And the idea was that it was meant to sort of map out how nuclear fallout would disperse after a nuclear attack. And so the cover story, or at least the story they have for why they did it, is that they were just looking at, how would these particles disperse into an urban population. And this was a very strange thing. Nobody knew about it that I knew, even though there had been some stories about it prior to that. And one of the strangest parts about it was that there were basically two main spots where they were spraying from. One of them was Pruitt-Igoe, which is pretty well known as a predominantly black public housing unit in St. Louis that was later demolished and destroyed. And the other one was at an intersection called Grand and Gravois, which was just a couple blocks from where my parents, where my mom grew up and her family. And they've always had health problems. My uncle, who I was very close to, died at 39 of a very rare nasopharyngeal carcinoma. My grandpa died fairly young of melanoma. My mom had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. My aunt gave birth to a baby where it was born with the organs on the outside. Which is something that happens a lot in populations that are hit with depleted uranium, incidentally.
Is that like when there's – I know because my dad's a pharmacist. He was telling me once about like babies that are born without like a face. Like they don't have the eyes.
That didn't happen here, although I've heard about that with Agent Orange. I heard a story one time that was just horrifying where women in Vietnam still are having birth defects from Agent Orange, and a woman gave birth to a ball. It was literally described as a ball. So there was no, there were no features, there were no arms, there was no face exactly. It was just a ball. That's always stuck with me. But this was more like, It happens where the organs are all kind of in a sac that's outside of the body. And, I think it's almost never something that's survivable. That baby died a week after birth. So, you know, I can't direct – I guess I can't – talking about conspiracy theory and conspiracy fact, I can't know for certain that this spraying program is what led to – these health problems in my family. I certainly don't know that. And St. Louis has a lot of other nuclear history, and Monsanto is here. I mean, there's a lot. They produced Agent Orange across the river. So there's a lot here that probably could lead to various health problems anyway. But this woman who kind of first came out with the story, she had FOIA'd a bunch of documents. Her name's Lisa Martino Taylor. And she wrote a dissertation based on this you can get for free online. And then she also wrote a book, which unfortunately is priced kind of high because it's one of those Rutledge things, called Behind the Fog. And that book laid out just a kind of bevy of insane stories related to radiological weapons testing. I mean, there are stories about them without people's knowledge putting radioactive isotopes in oatmeal for kids and telling them it was some kind of diet program, and they were monitoring, but they were actually monitoring the effects that radiation would have on them. They took like terminal cancer patients and basically injected them full of as much radiation as their body could take, or to see how much their body could take. A guy crashed his car on a military base, and they started doing radiation testing on him for weeks and weeks and weeks. And the guy eventually just he jumped out the window and escaped. And the spraying that happened in St. Louis was something that happened actually a lot of different places. They sprayed from planes. They dropped all of these radiation balls on a place in Texas. Obviously, they did the atom bomb testings out in New Mexico, which everybody knows about. They had done a similar spraying in Minnesota. They had done one in Winnipeg. They had done one in the UK. But what this book really argued is that although officially the story was that they were spraying zinc, cadmium, sulfide, they were actually, or she strongly implies in the book, that they were really spraying strontium-90, which is known to be extremely radioactive. And so that they were not really testing dispersal, they were testing the effect of radiation on an urban population.
You know, real quick, I wanted to say, this reminds me of a little bit of the Tuskegee syphilis experiment where, they basically allowed these African-Americans didn't tell them they had syphilis, or they just didn't really treat them for it to see what the effects would be. That went on from, I think, 1932 to 1972, and it was done by the U.S. Public Health Service. And that's all proven. That's one of the reasons the African-American community in our country has, a healthy distrust of the American government and sort of, the establishment, so to speak. And also, real quick, with that book, Behind the Fog, if people look in the right places, they may be able to find an ebook of it. I'm not endorsing piracy, though. And also, Routledge, I believe, is a academic press, right?
They are. And it's basically a rewrite of her dissertation, which I know is for free. You can get that on archive.org. I mean, that's readily available out there. So it's pretty much the same information. But yes, it is very similar to the Tuskegee experiments. It's similar to some of the stuff that's been coming out related to MKUltra with LSD experiments and testing on various people. And she actually is a sociologist, so she was attacking it from kind of a sociological point of view, and she has a really good part of the question she's trying to answer with the book is, how was this allowed to happen? How did people think it was okay to do this? And she has a really great term, I don't know that she coined it or it comes from somewhere else, called elite deviance. And I think that term explains a lot, that there's kind of a self-selection process that goes on for people to get high up in certain kinds of organizations, top secret military experiments, the CIA, stuff like this, where it's selecting for people who are somewhat sociopathic. And certainly Oppenheimer was involved in some of the research around, obviously was hugely involved in radiological weapons research. And there are insane stories about Oppenheimer where he poisoned an apple in college and left it on his professor's desk for him to eat it, and he got poisoned from it. It reminds me also of John Kiriakou, I think, has talked about that the CIA, when they're recruiting people, they go through all this testing and questioning, and one of the things they're looking for is sociopathic tendencies. Not necessarily that you are a sociopath, but that you have a kind of barrier between your emotions or your morality and what you're able to do in your actions. So anyway, I can't prove the strontium-90 thing. I certainly can't prove that my family's medical problems stem directly from that. But certainly everybody in my family believes that. A lot of them have read the book. And so I think that's – in any way, reading the book, there are a lot of things which are very provable, which are not disputed at all, which are very insane and would seem crazy to just tell somebody out of the blue. And that's what kind of set me on the path of thinking that there is sort of a – there's a lot that's hidden. There's a sort of hidden web underneath the sort of veneer of everyday average reality. And that's when I started kind of getting more involved in looking at, parapolitical events, conspiracies, things like that.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I did not know the author of Behind the Fog, Lisa, what was it,
Martino Taylor. She's really not, I mean, she was just she'd been like a legal assistant and then went to grad school later in life, and kind of happened on this topic by accident. So she's not like a widely known figure. I think she just teaches at a community college around here. So she's not like a major academic figure or anything.
Well, you know, sociologists can be really good with a lot of this stuff. I know I always mention to people in sociology, there's a lot of talk about production analysis, which is like, well, where do ideas come from? And it's sort of similar to what people say conspiracy theorists do, connecting the dots on who is publishing what. You know, when a place like Regnery was publishing sort of racial pseudoscience, that would be doing a production analysis of that. So there's a lot of times where sociologists actually hit on a lot of similar material. It's one of the reasons I like sociologists a lot. And I did not know about elite deviance theory. That seems pretty pretty apropos given the Jeffrey Epstein story now.
Yes, exactly. Just the term elite deviance, I mean, it brings you right to Jeffrey Epstein and the innumerable people who knew what was going on with him or had some inclination or participated and certainly did nothing to turn him in or, turn themselves in or anything like that. So it's kind of that old George Carlin joke that people love to bring up, you know, it's a big club and you're not in it.
I was going to say, I've always found it funny because the people that laugh at that Carlin joke are, you know, a lot of the times the people he's actually making fun of in that joke.
Yeah, it's true, for sure.
Well, I wanted to ask, after you read the Behind the Fog book and look into this stuff in St. Louis, what do you start, like, reading and like that's considered parapolitical or conspiratorial? Maybe you could outline that a bit more for my listeners, or maybe what you think the most credible stuff there was.
Yeah, it's always interesting. I mean, I always like to not take one book or one person's point of view and just adopt it as my own. But I think after that, I'm trying to remember what all the stuff I sort of started looking into. I got into some of the information on biological weapons testing for a while. And later on, Jeffrey Kay, I don't know if you know him, but he released this document from the 50s that was all about the biological weapons, mostly testing that they had done on North Korea during the Korean War. And some of that stuff is crazy, like plague-infested rats that they dropped, and they would have like jars full of fleas that they would drop that were infected with Lyme disease or some kind of diseases and all kinds of just crazy military stuff like that I was into for a while. And then I guess at some point I got into I had always kind of mentally bracketed off a lot of the major conspiracy theories as just kind of like, who knows? I never really looked into them. So with JFK, I remember specifically that one of the my entry into it was actually through Jefferson Morley. And the reason for that was that he was Jefferson Morley is a pretty establishment mainstream kind of reporter. He had reported for the Wall Street Journal for a long time, total DC guy, you know, just a pretty straightforward reporter. And he was writing this stuff. He wrote a kind of short book called something like Oswald and the CIA or something like that. And it was just laying out Oswald's connections to the CIA. And for me, that was kind of an important entry into that subject because, you know, I don't know anything about ballistics. So when people start talking about ballistics, I can try to understand what they're saying, but it's not going to be something that really convinces me 100% one way or the other. But when somebody is laying out information about how the, you know, the named assassin has all these connections prior to the assassination with the CIA, then it makes me think, well, there's more going on here than just a lone wolf person, right? So from there, I got into some of the JFK stuff. I'm certainly not an expert in it, but, you know, I read the James Douglas book, JFK and the Unspeakable, which speaking of the conspiracy being the new fad right now, I noticed Tulsi Gabbard, she posted something to Instagram where she was holding that book, like it was visible in her arms. So I thought that was kind of an interesting little peek in the way that these things peek into the mainstream.
That's like when Hillary Clinton was spotted with those UFO books, because I guess she went to a meeting with the Rockefellers, and, you know, one of the Rockefellers is really into the UFO thing. So, yeah, it's similar in a way.
The UFO thing is a huge head trip to me because that has been rolled out in a very mainstream way recently with that New York Times articles about the sightings, and they released that video. And the Clinton connection is very strange, too, because John Podesta is really into it. And there's that whistleblower guy whose name escapes me, who supposedly was kind of the head of the warehouse where they have all of these supposed flying saucers.
Oh, Hangar 18?
Maybe.
Or Area 51?
I think it was something different. I mean, I know Hangar 18, the Megadeth album, certainly. This was something different. But it was the same kind of idea, or the same thing. It was some secret naval intelligence program, and it turned out that the program had a pretty big funding, and the funding was running out, and then Harry Reid personally intervened to get a bunch of money allocated to keep it open or whatever. And Harry Reid's a big UFO guy. And then, anyway, this guy who is the head spun off into this thing called To the Stars Academy, which Tom DeLonge from Blink-182 is involved in there, and all kinds of just weird, you know, just weird people from...
Peter Lavenda.
Peter Lavenda is in there, yes, Peter Lavenda.
Peter Lavenda is a really weird character. For folks that don't know, he wrote a book on the history of Nazis and the occult. He's written some stuff about the Vatican rat lines and bringing the Nazis over. But he also is probably the guy, I'm pretty sure of this because I have credible sources on it, that is behind the Simon Necronomicon. So he wants to be a historian on one hand, but he's also very much, you know, in the occult scene on the other hand.
Right. And one of the other, it's not Lavenda, it's one of the other guys involved, was involved in all of these remote viewing, supposed remote viewing experiments with Uri Geller back in the 70s. And there's actually a funny video because it's the guy whose name I can't remember. There's video of Uri Geller supposedly doing his remote viewing stuff, and the image that he draw, they would do this thing where you draw an image on a card and then he put it in an envelope and Uri Geller would, you know, do his Karnak routine and pretend to be able to see it or whatever. And, the image that he draws is actually a flying saucer, which I thought was kind of funny.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me because I've often wondered if a lot of this UFO stuff is cover stories. When I think of Area 51, Area 51 got real big when this Nevada reporter, what's his name? George Knapp, who now works for Coast to Coast AM, he interviewed this guy, Bob Lazar. And I'm just going over this for listeners that may be unfamiliar. Lazar is this guy who claimed to have worked for Area 51. And, you know, he talked about reverse engineering UFOs there and all this stuff. But adjacent to that, there was a court case going on where employees at Area 51 were suing the government. Jonathan Turley, I believe, was famously involved in this case. But they were suing because of, like, toxic waste and, you know, employees getting sick there. But no one talks about that story. They talk about, you know, Bob Lazar or...
Right.
Are you familiar with the Paul Benowitz case?
No, I'm not.
Paul Benowitz was this guy, I believe, in New Mexico. Greg Bishop has written about this in a book called Project Beta. Benowitz was really into UFOs, and he was doing this radar tracking stuff. I could be getting some of these details wrong, but he was doing radar tracking, and you know, he basically ended up radar tracking a secret military base. And the Air Force got really upset about this. So they actually did a disinformation campaign against him. And they're like, yeah, the UFOs are real. You know, yeah, it's aliens. We're fighting the aliens. And he eventually lost his mind over it. But that stuff's all pretty much confirmed that there was this legit disinformation case, disinformation campaign against Benowitz. So I think a lot of times UFOs are used in that way by the government.
Absolutely. And that's, I'd actually, that's interesting. I'd like to know more about that story because it fits in with my kind of theory of UFOs, which is basically they are just being used as cover for either military, you know, weapons projects that are being developed or some other kinds of surveillance capabilities or something that the military has and doesn't want us to sort of know about. And so you put out this UFO story and everybody looks over here and nobody's looking at just the more, I don't know, credible seeming idea that it's some kind of technology that's being developed.
Well, I mean, that gets into my favorite conspiracy that no one likes to talk about. I mean, you have, I do have a certain, I can be very skeptical about a lot of conspiracy theories. I sort of get where journalists like Joseph Flatley, who I've interviewed, or that recent book, Republic of Lies, where they're very critical of conspiracy theories. I sort of get where they're coming from on one level. Because to me, a lot of the times, conspiracy theories themselves are the conspiracy. Does that make sense? Yep.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think, for me, I don't like a lot of the psychologizing of conspiracy theorists that goes on. Because, yes, there are conspiracy theorists who are crazy or don't think things through correctly. But there is the flip side of that is that the mainstream takes this view that, like, buying into any conspiracy that turns out to be incorrect or not quite correct is, like, sort of the worst thing you can do. And so there's a lot of barriers that are put up around the JFK assassination or 9/11 or even certain parts of Iran-Contra, even though that's a little bit more mainstream. And there's never a psychologizing of that. You know, there's never a psychologizing of what is the psychology that leads people to defend institutions, which we know are corrupt, and to not think that the hundreds of different bizarre cases that we know about of, say, drug trafficking being somehow related to the CIA, that, you know, to put those all together into an idea that, like, the CIA may be involved in drug trafficking is sort of crazy. Sorry, and I kind of lost my the trail of my analysis there, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's all kinds of not thinking about things that's not sort of thought about in a psychological way, and there is with conspiracies. And you're right that a lot of conspiracies are just being used as cover for deeper things that are even more conspiratorial in a way going on.
Yeah, well, I always think about the whole Illuminati thing, right? You know, that used to be the big thing when I first started college. You know, oh, Lady Gaga, the Illuminati. And I'm like, if you think about where the Illuminati conspiracy theories actually come from, they start during, like, the French Revolution. And there's this intense fear of the Illuminati because you had sort of these Catholic authors saying, oh, it's the Illuminati behind it. And I'm like, well, maybe that's their way of scaring the plebs, you know, the powers that be in France at the time, right? Let's scare the plebs by telling them it's this secret cabal. When really the historical Illuminati, I actually kind of, you know, I kind of dig the historical Illuminati because they were sort of they were very progressive, like secular humanists. And we see that now when, you know, right-wing conspiracy theorists like Alex Jones or the late Ted Gunderson talk about the Illuminati conspiracy, they're often really just talking about secular humanism, and that's their way to attack it. Oh, they're not just secular humanists, they're not just atheists, they're, you know, Satan-worshipping pedophiles. You know, I feel like they politicize a lot of these topics.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and there are a lot of people out there who I think are basically spreading disinformation in the guise of being the truth teller in terms of conspiracies. And I really think that's what was going on with Ted Gunderson. There are other people who kind of fit that role. Even Cernovich now, I was thinking about, is a little bit kind of filling that Ted Gunderson role where he pops up in a million different stories and he does it in a way that's very self-serving, and he's almost invariably spreading some version of a conspiracy involving liberal pedophile elites or whatever.
Yeah, I don't think he cares much about pedophilia. I think he wants to use this as a battering ram to say, oh, look, all the leftists are pedophiles.
Well, definitely. And he was early on spreading the Pizzagate story, which was this, in retrospect, it looks like a diversion away from something like Epstein, which is a very real case of an elite pedophile who was connected to hundreds of different people within the elite from all sides of the political spectrum. Whereas Pizzagate focused on a very narrow story of James Alefantis, the owner of Comet Ping Pong, which I've been to several times, probably a dozen different times when I lived in D.C. I never saw any evidence of child trafficking. That James Alefantis and Podesta and Hillary were involved in their own child sex trafficking ring that it operated through this pizza place, that they were using code words, and it set everybody off on this path that really had nothing to do with anything and didn't lead anywhere. And there's never been a victim who's come forward to claim that James Alefantis abused them, or Podesta, or Clinton, or whatever, while totally ignoring, you know, again, the Epstein story that would have touched Clinton but also touches Trump and touches, you know, just laundry list of people throughout the kind of elite sphere.
I think it touches Clinton in a very different way, though, than it would Trump, because I think Clinton, you know, the stories that Juanita Broderick and some others have told, I think they're more credible than people in the 90s wanted to admit, and I've heard liberals say that now. But I'm not sure he was involved with Epstein on that level of, like, abusing the young girls. I do think he was looking the other way. Whereas with Trump, we have a woman, Katie Johnson, who is, you know, basically saying, you know, I was abused.
Right.
It's hard to talk about sometimes. It's dark stuff.
It is very dark. And I mean, and Katie Johnson is, her accusation really is a forcible rape that Trump committed against her when she was 13 years old, I think. So it doesn't even have the veneer of, oh, she was 17 and maybe she consented or something like that. It's a story about a very forcible, violent action that she's accusing Trump of doing. As far as Clinton being involved, I mean, I really don't think we know. He was involved with Epstein pretty heavily, I think one of the more interesting things is that Epstein at least claims to have helped set up the Clinton Foundation for, I don't know if he was providing the seed money or something like that. Clinton certainly flew on the planes something like 20 times, even though he claimed it was only four. Epstein had like 20 different numbers for Clinton. And a photo recently came out. It's weird that it had not been out there until recently, of Epstein and Clinton on what appears to be the plane, but the caption, because it came from an old Vanity Fair piece, is that they were in Brunei. And Brunei has its own sordid history of sex trafficking and women basically being sex slaves for the Sultan of Brunei, which then again connect, this is, you know, the dots you can connect. And then the Sultan of Brunei connects back to Trump because Trump bought Adnan Khashoggi's yacht through the Sultan of Brunei, some kind of securitization deal or something.
Adnan Khashoggi, for my listeners, probably the biggest international arms dealer of the 20th century. You know, yep. Man of scandal. You know, I always tell people, if you do Adnan Khashoggi research, it becomes like the 6 degrees of Adnan Khashoggi, because he ties into everything almost.
Yeah, it's like the 2 degrees of Adnan Khashoggi, because he's tied in with Iran-Contra. He's tied in with Trump and Clinton. I mean, he's tied in with basically every person you can imagine.
I mean, even something like Princess Diana. I mean, he had a connection to Princess Diana. Yeah, yeah. And Jamal Khashoggi.
Right. And Jamal Khashoggi was his cousin or nephew or something. And Jamal Khashoggi is connected to Osama bin Laden. So there's just like the web you can weave out of the Khashoggis is very deep and very dense. And interestingly, Trump bought his yacht from Adnan Khashoggi, which was, I think, claimed to be the biggest yacht in the world at the time. And Robert Maxwell, the yacht that he ended up dying on, the Lady Ghislaine, named for his daughter, Ghislaine Maxwell, was bought from, I think his name is Imad Khashoggi, but Adnan Khashoggi's brother. So somehow they were also deeply involved in all in getting yachts to all of the elites there in the 80s somehow. Of course, the Lady Ghislaine is the yacht that Robert Maxwell then was last on before he died. And there's also an article that's been circulating recently from like the late 80s where there was a party on Robert Maxwell's yacht, and there were all kinds of people there, including, I believe, Adnan Khashoggi, including Trump, including Ghislaine Maxwell, and I can't remember all the people on there, but it's another one of those wells to dig through.
Yeah, it gets really, really weird. It's why I haven't, I can be fairly mainstream with a lot of things, but there's a reason that I don't completely dismiss a lot of this stuff, because I grew up reading Peter Dale Scott, who I consider like the foremost scholar of parapolitics. He's wonderful.
Yes, absolutely.
But also guys like Dave Emery and Mae Brussel, who was basically putting the pieces together on Watergate before anyone else.
Right.
Emory did that, I believe, with Iran-Contra. So these people are really worth listening to, because they sort of just collect this information and they start putting things together just by reading news articles. And I mean, there is something there a lot of times. That's why I think it's wrongheaded to dismiss everything out of hand.
Yeah, absolutely. And with Epstein, the connections are so broad that I think you have to look into them. I mean, I listened to your interview with Marlon Ettinger, and he was pouring a little bit of water on the Robert Maxwell connection to Epstein. But I mean, I think it's still worth interrogating, certainly, that Jeffrey Epstein, this, you know, guy who's connected to everybody, is his sort of procurer of young girls, is the daughter of a guy who is probably a Mossad spy, if not a million other things. And with Epstein also, I mean, another thing, I guess I'll take Marlon Ettinger to task slightly for the point about Donald Barr, because I think he had said that Donald Barr, the father of Bill Barr, the current attorney general, that he did not hire Epstein at the Dalton School. But that was, I think, based on a Daily Beast article, and they've since updated the article. to say that they contacted the headmaster after Barr and asked him, and he said that he had not hired him, and that Barr had been the headmaster until June 30th, and Epstein started later that year. So it's most likely that Barr was the one who hired him, which is interesting for a few different reasons, because Donald Barr was OSS and had been at Columbia, and these are kind of prominent recruitment area, you know, elite universities are certainly very prominent recruitment vehicles for the CIA and spies. And his own son, of course, was in the CIA at that time, Bill Barr, and was in the CIA while he was going to law school, which I thought was kind of a strange thing. And then ends up right after that working for right under George H.W. Bush and George H.W. Bush's very brief tenure as director of the CIA, essentially trying to keep stuff away from the Church Committee and to hide some of the documents related to the JFK assassination from the HSCA, I believe. So I don't know where I'm going with all of that exactly, except to say that the Epstein connections, if you peel back any one of them, you're going to go down a long way. And Barr is certainly a figure I find pretty interesting, William Barr.
Well, there's so many rabbit holes that one can go down. And that's why I can understand why some people don't want to go down those rabbit holes, because it can get really messy. But at the same time, I understand why it may be necessary to, in some cases, go down these rabbit holes. You know, just looking at the media reaction to Epstein, I've been very frustrated because, you know, first it was hashtag Clinton body count. And then it was hashtag Trump's body count. And, you know, that was just political point scoring. And that pissed me off because I think, you know, the victims of this, of Epstein and Maxwell and others, they deserve more than people using this for political point scoring. But almost even as annoying as that, no, it is just as annoying, is this concern trolling over the rise of conspiracy theories. I'm like, well, you know, the institutions in this country, they failed. You know, we can go back to Watergate, then we can go to Iran-Contra, then we can go to the Iraq War, then we can go to the 08 financial crisis, right up to Trump winning an election that everyone was saying, oh, it's not even possible. And yet we're supposed to believe our establishment sort of legacy media. We're supposed to believe our government. We're supposed to believe big business. I mean, I get why people are into the conspiracy topic right now.
Yeah, well, the establishment seems to be trying to fit people into silo people into different perspectives. So you can either be a right-wing conspiracy theorist, or you can be a left-wing conspiracy theorist, or you can be a more protector of the establishment and say conspiracy theories are for nut jobs and don't even touch them. When in fact, there are conspiracies out there, there are conspiracy facts, and they cross multiple through every partisan divide you can imagine. And one of the things recently that I think really kind of highlighted that for me was related to Donald Barr, it was related to William Barr and Robert Mueller. And so Robert Mueller was this figure on the liberal side where he was going to be the white knight and he was going to uncover all of the Russia conspiracy that Trump had you know, colluded with Russia to steal the election and all this. And on the other, and then kind of on the other side, now it's turned over to where William Barr is going to be the white knight for the Republican side. And he's going to expose actually that the deep state was trying to take down Trump. And this was all a concerted effort on the part of, you know, Democrats and the liberal establishment in the established government to just take down a president they didn't like. When in fact, if you look at Mueller and Barr's history, for one, they've been friends for like 30 years or something. And they've both been involved in practically every cover up you can imagine from the late 70s on. I mean, Mueller was involved in, Mueller and Barr together were involved in pursuing an innocent man for the Lockerbie bombing of Pan Am 103, which was blown out of the sky and was blamed on this guy, Al Megrahi, who was supposedly working on behalf of Gaddafi. to do a basically to blow a plane out of the sky for some reason that was never quite explained, when in fact it was almost certainly committed by, well, it's hard to say who exactly committed it, but all the evidence points toward that it was committed by this group called the People's Front for the Liberation of Palestine, GC, General Committee, or something like that, who is known for creating the exact kind of explosive that was probably used on that for that attack. And then Barr is even connected into the PFLP-GC because as a lawyer in the early 80s, he had worked for this law firm where one of their clients was Edwin Wilson. And Edwin Wilson ended up going to prison for basically running arms to Gaddafi. And his defense was that he was doing it on behalf of the CIA, and he had been a former CIA agent. And Barr was the lawyer who actually helped set up some of the company, some of the front companies that Edwin Wilson was using to funnel guns to Gaddafi and also probably on the other side to the PFLP-GC. So that's one of many, but there's like Iraqgate, BCCI, 9/11, Whitey Bulger, Anthrax. I mean, those were all Mueller cover-ups, and William Barr has an equally long history as attorney general. He was attorney general under George H.W. Bush, and at that time he was basically pushing for military strikes on Libya, I think, and assisting rebels down in Panama, trying to gin up a revolution there before the U.S. went in and just invaded, and all kinds of other things. So these guys are working hand in glove, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And the idea that Mueller was going to take down – that Mueller and Barr were at loggerheads. This was this big narrative out there in the media that, you know, Mueller was furious with Barr and that Barr was trying to quash Mueller's investigation. I mean, they were both working they were both working together to get to the conclusion which they got to, I think, which is that Russia did hack – and leave it a little bit open-ended as to whether Trump was involved or not. You can buy that sort of conspiracy theory or not.
Yeah, it's really interesting, too, because you mentioned BCCI. No one even knows about that anymore. And it was a big deal in the 80s. You know, Jonathan Quitney's The Crimes of Patriots is a really good book to read on that, and inspired Danny Casolaro's whole investigation into what he called the octopus.
Right. But
you don't really hear people talk about that anymore. And it's interesting to me. You mentioned Pizzagate, and I know you wanted to talk about that. All these people who push Pizzagate, I find it odd because, well, I'll give an example to make my point. Someone like Alex Jones wants to push these things like Pizzagate, although he's been back and forth on that.
Yeah.
But Alex Jones... Mr. I'm exposing the Bilderbergs, I'm exposing Bohemian Grove. Alex Jones is probably tied to the CNP. Do you know about the CNP?
No.
That's the Council for National Policy. It's It's basically a very, very secretive DC think tank. Jerome Corsi has been involved in it. Dr. Stanley Monteith, a lot of the people in the conspiracy circles. It's a social conservative think tank. I believe it was started by Tim LaHaye, actually, of Left Behind fame.
Okay.
And they're hyper secretive. They're supposed to be a right-wing equivalent to the CFR. But none of these guys will talk about the CNP. None of them. And it operates in the same way a Bilderberg group does or a Bohemian Grove does. And yet they will not talk about it. It blows my mind that these people can act like they're the heroes exposing the truth. Even someone like Ted Gunderson, who I have it on Ed Opperman's ward, worked for COINTELPRO against the Black Panthers. And we're supposed to trust these people? Oh, my God.
Yeah, Gunderson is a crazy figure on that level because, yeah, I think it's confirmed that he worked on COINTELPRO. And Ed Opperman has a claims to have talked to a woman who went down to the L.A. FBI office in like the late 90s, and Gunderson was still hanging around and said, yeah, I work here, meaning he, in other words, said he worked for the FBI throughout the entire time that he was, you know, involved in the Oklahoma City bombing investigation and the Franklin scandal and the McMartin preschool and various other satanic ritual abuse stories and all this other stuff. So I don't know if that's true, in fact, that he did work for the FBI, but it seems pretty clear to me that a guy who is involved in COINTELPRO, which is all about infiltration of dangerous groups and dangerous ideas.
Subversives,
right. That he would then kind of turn around and just be the, again, the kind of white knight blowing the lid off the satanic pedophile secret cabal. It doesn't wash with me. To me, a guy who's involved in COINTELPRO, you know, you're going to have to do a lot to convince me that you're not still involved in working on behalf of the kind of elite establishment.
Well, I know a lot of the parents, apparently, in the McMartin preschool case, hate Ted Gunderson's guts. Because,
is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if it was Jackie McGauley that said it, but I know there are some parents that were like, he ruined that case because he came in and started talking about witches flying around on broomsticks and sort of sensationalizing it, tabloidizing right. it, and ruined everything. I mean, I'm skeptical of a lot of the McMartin preschool stuff, and that may be my own bias because I don't want to – I think people can very easily turn a lot of the SRA stuff into a witch hunt against Wiccans and other assorted occultists. But, yeah, I mean, Gunderson is someone who seems to turn anything he touches into shit.
Yeah, exactly. Well, for example, the Johnny Gosch disappearance, I think I mentioned to you off air that I had watched the Who Took Johnny documentary last night, which I think has problems on its own. But that Johnny Gosch story, there was this whole idea that Jeff Gannon, who was this White House reporter, who was also a gay call boy or whatever would be a more PC term for that, who'd kind of been in the White House or something. Anyway, that he was Johnny Gosch, and apparently the person who originated – I don't know if he originated the theory, but he was certainly the one who brought it to Noreen Gosch, Johnny Gosch's mom, was Ted Gunderson. And he claimed to have some videotape that proved it of somebody on some tape somewhere saying something that supposedly proved that. So I absolutely agree that he's a guy who in a way probably takes a side that is – somewhat correct on a lot of stories, or that there is something there, and turns it into just a circus sideshow where nobody can take it seriously.
And for my listeners, you know, because like I said, I always assume I have noobs.
Sure.
Johnny Gosch is probably, he was like the first milk carton kid, essentially.
You're right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he disappeared from West Des Moines, and then there were two other kids who ended up disappearing. And his mom was a very zealous advocate for finding him. And I don't, you know, I don't want to disparage her, but I don't know that I completely trust some of the angles. She claimed that he showed up at her doorstep like 20 years after the disappearance and some other stuff that maybe didn't seem quite totally believable to me. And that story, one of the theories and the theory that's kind of put forward in that Who Took Johnny movie is that it was connected to the Franklin scandal, which again, for your listeners, was this supposed, alleged, I guess I should say, pedophile sex trafficking ring operating out of Omaha, Nebraska, and supposedly kind of headed by this guy, Larry King, not the CNN guy, but a guy who ran a savings and loan there. And Ted Gunderson was involved in the Franklin scandal story, too. And I believe he was brought in by the kind of main lawyer slash investigator guy who is putting forward that story, which was John DeCamp.
Also a senator.
Yes, he was a state senator and had run unsuccessfully for Congress from Nebraska, too. And he has his own crazy history where he was involved in the CIA. He was involved in the Phoenix program. He was involved related to that is time in Vietnam. He was involved in this thing called Operation Baby Lift, which was essentially an actual child, not sex trafficking, but child trafficking ring of taking quote unquote orphans out of Vietnam and essentially giving them away to families in the United States. And his, the head of the Phoenix program and his kind of mentor was William Colby, who went on to become a CIA director and who was brought on to be an investigator in the Franklin scandal story. And specifically, he was brought on to investigate this mysterious plane crash that had happened of Gary Canestraro, I think was his name, who was supposedly coming back with all of the – he had been on a trip and flying a small airplane, and it may have blown up or may have crashed, probably blown up. I mean, it seems credible, and had a bunch of information implicating a higher level to the conspiracy, possibly connected to a whole CIA or some kind of larger sex trafficking thing going on in Washington, D.C. Anyway, so I guess what I'm trying to get at here is that a lot of stories which are conspiracies end up being managed by the people who don't want those conspiracies to come out, and thereby inject people who seem trustworthy. I mean, if you listen to John DeCamp, he seems trustworthy. He seems like he really cared, and he wrote a whole book about it, and he kept on the case for a little while afterwards until he died.
He always seemed a lot more credible than Ted Gunderson, who Ted Gunderson yes. just got increasingly more and more crazy. I think the last thing Gunderson did was he tried to get involved in David Carradine's autoerotic asphyxiation
yes.
death, and he was claiming it
Filipino
was
trannies.
yes, yeah, yeah, tranny to hookers.
Used his word. I mean, yeah.
Right, right. I don't. People, we're using his words. We're not saying, yeah.
yes, yeah, yeah. I would not call them that, and I don't know that they existed anyway. So I think you know it's fair to say it. So yeah, with John DeCamp, I don't know. He's a curious figure to me. But certainly the way that he brought William – so he had been the personal attorney for the senator, state senator whose last name was Schmidt, who was kind of the main guy on the committee that investigated the Franklin story. And he had introduced Schmidt to William Colby, I think, in the early 80s. And then Schmidt wanted to put Colby on the – basically to hire him as the primary investigator for that committee, and was kind of shot down by the rest of the committee. And sometimes that's used as evidence that the committee was trying to cover up the story. But I think they maybe had legitimate reasons, because there was already indications that the CIA might be implicated in the child sex trafficking ring. And why would you bring on a former CIA director to be your investigator on that? So I don't know. I've always wondered – I've wondered lately if maybe – Colby somehow wasn't involved in the Canestraro death and was somehow being fed some information. He certainly would have the means to arrange for that kind of hit. So I don't know. That's just a theory, but.
Well, I mean, like I said, it gets really crazy. I mean, we've been talking about DeCamp, Gunderson, and all these sort of, you know, to me, they're just these sort of right-wing figures. And I'm sorry if I hone in a little bit too much on that, but it just annoys me how, you know, someone will mention to me, I still have people that will be like, what do you think of Gary Allen's book? I forget what it was called. It's that John Bircher book.
Oh, okay. I know vaguely what you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, it influenced Alex Jones, and I'm like,
right.
I don't know. I mean, the John Birchers are connected to H.L. Hunt, a Texas business tycoon. I mean, mm-hmm. a lot of the John Birch Society began with, you know, these Texas oil types. I'm like, well, why would I trust them any more than I trust anyone else when it comes to this stuff? I want to hammer home that point, because I find it odd how these people are able to hijack any type of issue, whether it's Bohemian Grove or the Bilderbergs, and sensationalize it, tabloidize it, and no one questions their background. No one questions what they may be trying to do
right.
To sort of get the heat off them. And I think that's especially true in Pizzagate.
Yeah. I mean, Pizzagate just seems transparently some kind of operation, some kind of disinformation operation to me, based in large part – and I'm not saying there – I think there were people, genuine people, who kind of latched onto Pizzagate and ended up taking it in directions that were actually fruitful, meaning they expanded outward from Pizzagate to – Pedo Gate, which I'm sure had all of its own problems too, but at least I think was looking into Epstein, was looking back to the Dutroux affair, was looking at Franklin, things which I think have a lot more meat on the bones than the Comet ping pong story. And the people who were pushing Pizzagate itself, the kind of branded, it seemed to, the story seemed to come out with its own brand, hashtag Pizzagate, were Mike Cernovich and Jack Posobiec, who's a former naval intelligence, or he was a naval intelligence officer until he was demoted because of Pizzagate, I think, who had worked at Gitmo and has been involved in all kinds of very shady operations, pushing narratives that are highly dubious and almost certainly not true. And so the Pizzagate story just feels like a managed operation to me. And that I think is happening a lot with all kinds of different conspiracies, where they get managed and they get manipulated. And the whole point is to kind of muddy the waters so that you don't know what to believe anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it all feels very astroturfed. I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Yes. Oh, no. Yeah, absolutely. And Cernovich is just such a strange guy. I mean, I think you've maybe seen this recently where Lee Stranahan has been kind of going after Cernovich, Posobiec, and Steve Bannon a lot lately. Steve Bannon, by the way, has his own connection to Jeffrey Epstein. He met with him last year, well after all the heat was on him.
Stranahan also claims that they met in 2016 as well, just to throw that out there.
Okay.
Twice.
Yeah, right. So that's very interesting. And Steve Bannon, there's a weird story with him that he had this like porn meth house. Have you ever heard about this down in Florida?
I've covered that with Paris and Ed Opperman, yeah.
Oh, okay, great. That may have even been when I first heard about it. But one of the very few really good, in-depth, interesting investigations ever done by Sheer Blue, I think, was the article that they did on that porn meth house. So I don't know what was going on there. Steve Bannon is currently trying to set up some what he calls a gladiator school in Italy. I mean, that guy is just tied into all kinds of bizarre and crazy stuff. And then Stranahan has also recently been on this tip about Cernovich in El Paso a week before the El Paso shooting, along with Steve Bannon and a bunch of other right-wing figures for this build the wall, we build the wall, where private funding to build a wall down there in some privately owned land that's on the border or whatever. And Stranahan's been getting very interestingly close to suggesting some kind of like domestic Gladio operation is going on with Cernovich and Bannon. I don't know if he would put it in those terms exactly, but he's been saying a lot that's very close to suggesting the kind of strategy of tension sort of idea of like they're whipping up sentiments on both sides and specifically on the right and essentially causing these mass shootings to happen through their kind of heated rhetoric and their injection into stories like that. So I don't know. That's an interesting one to keep an eye on. I don't know exactly where that's going or what will be revealed, if anything, from that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Operation Gladio is sort of one of these conspiracies that's probably more talked about now than it even was back in the day. It really centers around Europe in a lot of ways. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. I think people are more comfortable talking about conspiracies in Europe than they are in the U.S. I wonder why that is. But it's interesting because I see Gladio being used now a lot to basically everything is Gladio now to some people.
Yeah.
Every mass shooting is Gladio. And I'm like, I don't know about that.
I certainly don't know. Sybil Edmonds kind of she had talked about Gladio a lot too. And in terms of this Gladio 2 or Gladio B thing, that there was some kind of mass sequel going on with Gladio. But I haven't really followed her line of thinking on that too much. Is a little bit of a different subject with Cernovich. I had recently looked into him kind of related to that shooter thing to see if anything was there. And I was interested to find out that he was sort of involved with 8chan too. Which is where the shooter's manifesto was posted.
I believe that's also where, QAnon has been until it got shut down.
Yeah. QAnon was on 8chan after they, I think, got kicked off Reddit. And, the Poway shooting that happened earlier this year at the Poway synagogue, that shooter had also posted a manifesto on 8chan. And so all of those things together combined kind of led to 8chan getting shut down recently. And it was interesting to me to find out that Cernovich was friends with Frederick Brennan, a.k.a. Hot Wheels, the guy who started 8chan as a kind of spinoff, a more even more libertine, I guess you'd call it, spinoff of 4chan, where they were basically going to allow anything to be posted as long as it didn't overtly violate a law. And Cernovich at one time, I think, was even involved in trying to buy 8chan potentially. He offered legal advice to Fred Brennan, and he also shares a lawyer, the very skeezy lawyer Mark Randazza, with the current owner of 8chan, Tim something, I can't remember his last name. So his ties into that whole world do kind of lend, I don't know, they lend maybe just a bit of credence for me to some idea that there's some kind of manipulation of things going on, that maybe they're targeting the right people that they do think are prone to this kind of violent behavior, something like that. But certainly that's more just theory than fact at this point.
Well, I think, you know, it depends on how far you go with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the mainstream view now that a lot of mainstream sort of establishment journalists have, and they wouldn't term it this way, but what a lot of them are saying is that conspiracy theories are being weaponized. That's right. That's what, you know, they're saying about the Trump, talking about Clinton body count and whatnot. Trump Jr. Talking about the Clinton body count. They're essentially saying, the right is weaponizing conspiracy theories. They don't like to call that a conspiracy, though, for some reason. It just boggles my mind.
It's very strange. And also the idea that conspiracies are being weaponized is a pretty powerful way of, of getting things banned and getting media sort of shut down. It's an argument basically for what's been happening a lot, which is the kind of delegitimization of anything that's outside of the mainstream. I certainly don't like 8chan at all, but – and I don't know even exactly how I feel about it completely getting banned. But one of the things that I've found recently is that when things get banned, when people get banned on Twitter or websites basically fall down the memory hole, it makes it a lot harder to research the origins of things that were going on back then. So I was trying to look a little bit into the origins of Pizzagate and, like, you know, where exactly was this starting out there on the internet? And if you try to search for that on Twitter, it's like, you know that you're missing out on 90% of the content because all of these accounts have been banned by this point. And I think 4chan and 8chan are not archived by the Wayback Machine, Internet Archive. So it makes it very difficult to search for some of that stuff. And if the site goes down completely, then you've basically lost all of the research material that you would otherwise have in terms of trying to really suss through this stuff and figure out what was going on there. So, I have very mixed feelings about banning things like that and this push that's been going on to, try to just wipe things out. Even Alex Jones getting banned from Twitter, it was kind of and YouTube is kind of a problem because now you can't go back and look at old Alex Jones clips nearly as easily. You can't find his old tweets on certain subjects. Whereas that's, very helpful to do sometimes to figure out the origin of these ideas that are out there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm assuming you can tell now. I do believe that certain conspiracy theories are being weaponized. I just don't know that I agree mm-hmm. with banning a lot of speech regarding these things. I go back and forth on it. But I do think there is a weaponization going on. I just talked to Joseph Matheny about that on a recent episode. So I think that goes on, but I'm not sure banning stuff will ultimately quell all of this, especially because I think a lot of these people are going to go underground. I mean, we have, the Tor browsers now, the deep web, which, you know, Yasha Levine has written a lot about Surveillance Valley. I don't know that you can stop a lot of this stuff.
I don't think so. And I mean, one of the ideas I think that Yasha Levine had around Tor is that it's essentially a way of, well, I don't know if this was his idea exactly, but that they were able to basically backtrack most of the traffic on Tor, so it's never as secret as it seems. And in a way, it just gives them an excuse not, you know, if they miss things and they're on the dark web, they can blame it on it being on the dark web, while still kind of keeping their eye out too. So I don't know where I'm going with that exactly, but I guess part of what I'm thinking is that there has been kind of infiltration of these spaces. For example, there was that story, I think the guy Henry Crinkle on Twitter is his name, broke it about that the FBI had basically accidentally revealed that it was posting stuff on 8chan, and they were trying, and it was basically a kind of weaponization or manipulation of conspiracy theories, because they were trying to get people to, I believe, target Russia and to think about Russia as being the source of a lot of different conspiracy theories. And that's been weirdly something that Jack Posobiec has been pushing a lot lately, where he's been claiming that like the Washington Post is in the pocket of Russia or something. So I don't know. There's definitely an infiltration that's been going on there too.
I mean, doesn't 8chan itself have very weird origins?
Yeah, I tried to look into that a little bit too, and I ended up running across something that ended up just being fake from or at least I think it's probably fake, that was a Medium post from their lead developer claiming that they had been approached by Red Hat, the Linux company that has relationships with the NSA, and that Red Hat was trying to get them to install what would essentially be like a keylogger so that they could preserve everything that was basically ever typed into the site. I think that was all a lie. It was some kind of fake post, although it was weirdly specific, so I don't know exactly what the prank was there. But I do know that 8chan, basically 8chan was staying on the internet through the use of Cloudflare is the name of the company. And a lot of different websites use Cloudflare. And the way that Cloudflare works is that it protects you against DDoS attacks, where people just try to flood your site with traffic and crash it, by routing all of your traffic through Cloudflare's own servers. And Cloudflare – so basically Cloudflare de-encrypts all of the information that comes to it, and they can essentially see the source of all of the traffic coming into their own servers. So Cloudflare strongly denies that they have any relationship with the U.S. government or anything like that. But if you look into it, the guy who started Cloudflare said that he started it sort of at the behest or at the suggestion of the Department of Homeland Security. And the people involved in Cloudflare had been involved in this other thing that was literally called Operation Honeypot, which was like a way to sort of scam email scammers by getting them to reveal their information or something like that. So I don't know. I would think Cloudflare is definitely a place to look for a lot of this dark web infiltration that's been going on, because I have a feeling they're probably compromised on some level.
Well, you know, all of this stuff gets really weird for me because, you know, when you get into the really serious stuff, even the limited hangout, or what conspiracy theorists and people into parapolitics would call the limited hangout, mm-hmm. Is often just as bad as, you know, anything else. For instance, you know, you can go back to the World Trade Center bombing of 1993. They had an informant, Imad Salam, who was, like, tracking these terrorists as they're building the bomb.
Right.
And, I mean, at best, what Imad Salam was saying after the events happened, I think he eventually just quit being an informant because he got so angry with the bureaucratic bungling. That's bad enough on its own. Even with something like Oklahoma City, the ties into Elohim City, which is basically a private community of white supremacists. I mean, right. To me, it's like, you know, there's a difference between conspiracy and cover-up, but the cover-up itself is a conspiracy, of course. But, you know, even if they're covering up just failures of intelligence, I mean, that in itself is pretty bad. And also, it makes you wonder, you know, what else are they covering up?
Yeah, absolutely. When you see how many of these shooting events are where the shooter has some relationship or some connection to the FBI or other terrorist attacks. I mean, the Boston bombing is a good example of that, where they had been on the FBI's radar, and I think their uncle was an FBI informant. The Garland, Texas one is like crazy. That was the Draw Muhammad shooting, where there was like an FBI agent had been tracking the guy who did that shooting for, or I think it was maybe two people who'd done the shooting, for like months. And the FBI agent was there at the scene of the shooting and I think did not call it in. So the at best you're looking at extreme incompetence. And I tend to generally think that that's probably not the best view on it, that when all of these sort of I don't know what you want to call them, intelligence apparatuses have connections into things like this, there's probably more going on than just we were monitoring it and it was an asset who got out of hand kind of thing. But it's extremely difficult to ever prove anything for sure with that stuff.
Well, that's how it goes for a lot of these things. I mean,
yeah,
you know, even things that are proven, I think, get muddied now. You mentioned MK Ultra. Mm-hmm. Earlier. I mean, I think people don't take MKUltra seriously enough. That was a massive human rights violation.
Right.
And yet, people, I think, end up going towards things like Project Monarch, you know, yeah. Oh, the mind-controlled sex slaves that were created by the CIA for, you know, Bob Hope and Bill Clinton and, you know, Reptile Boxcar Willie, Kathy O'Brien was the one claiming all this stuff. And I'm like, no, I think a lot of that stuff is just porn for evangelical Christians in a lot of ways. And I also wonder if that stuff in and of itself is sort of disinformation campaigning.
I feel like it must be. I mean, for a while, if you went on YouTube and you would search for MKUltra, the stuff that would come up would be like, here's Al Roker doing something weird, and that's proof that is, you know, the programming had worn off, or they had to reboot him or something like that. It was all just ridiculous, silly stuff. Whereas, like you say, the actual connections, the actual things that happen with MKUltra are extremely dark and scary and grim. I know in Canada, there's actually a lawsuit going on right now for some of the people who were experimented on, have sued the Canadian government, I believe it is, for their involvement in allowing, you know, in knowing and allowing, I think it was LSD tests or something like that to go on. And even if you want to get, super conspiratorial about MKUltra, I mean, just look at some of the people who are connected to it. This new book that I haven't read yet, but the Tom O'Neill Chaos, the Charles Manson book.
I've been trying to get in contact with Tom. It's been very difficult.
Yeah, I'm sure he's getting a lot of requests now, because that surprisingly got a fair bit of mainstream play, which was interesting.
I mean, The Guardian is covering it.
Yeah, the New York Times even had an article about it, sympathetic. So, and that's all like Mabe Russell, you know, was doing that stuff back in like 1972 or something.
He's referenced Mabe Russell and Dave McGowan as being, you know, helpful to that book.
That was pretty cool if you can get one degree away from Dave McGowan into the mainstream, because, you know, I mean, he can be pretty out there. But yeah, and Tom O'Neill has also mentioned Dave Emery. He's mentioned Peter Dale Scott. He's mentioned all kinds of different kind of, you know, what would be dismissed as conspiracy theory people. But anyway, Charles Manson's connected MKUltra, the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, verified, you know, that he was being tested on, and also Whitey Bulger was a MKUltra subject, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So he had been tested on, I think, a juvenile detention facility back when he was younger. Don't quote me on that particular thing, but he definitely was an MKUltra subject. So, and again, bringing it to the FBI being connected, I mean, Whitey Bulger was protected in Boston for like decades while he was basically going on a citywide murder spree. So, you know, at best, the FBI was protecting its sort of favored asset. At worst, they were, you know, using him to cause chaos or something in Boston. I don't know. But anyway, if you want to go down the conspiracy theory angle on MKUltra, there's a million different places to go without having to be like, you know, every celebrity you've ever heard of is actually an MKUltra subject.
Well, yeah, it's funny, the Whitey Bulger thing, because, you know, there's a fairly mainstream journalist, Peter Lance, who wrote a whole book, Deal with the Devil. It's not about Bulger, it's about another guy, Gregory Scarpa, who was working as an informant for the FBI while being, like, you know, a really crazy hitman for the mob. And like, he actually, it's funny, Scarpa actually was, you know, he would kill his victims and then carve 666 on them. Like, he almost was like a serial killer in a way. You know,
right.
Yeah, so the relationship to the mob with a lot of this stuff is also really, really out there, but, you know, pretty provable.
Yeah, for sure. And sometimes the mob gets used, sometimes, like, there is that, you know, the Dan Moldea theory of the JFK assassination, like, the mob really took him out, and there wasn't any deeper element, it was just the mob. But I think it's more, so sometimes the mob can be used to kind of head off some of the deeper level conspiracy. But just the connection between the government and the mafia, I mean, it's at times you look at it, it's basically two sides of the same coin. I know that's something Doug Valentine has written about a fair amount, on the connections between, you know, the gangsters and the cops. And, you know, it's basically just one is the other and the other is the one.
We worked with them during World War II, Operation Underworld.
Right.
We worked with Lucky Luciano, our government.
Right. And there's one theory I know that's out there. There's, and I'm not even going to remember who did this, but on Twitter, that basically Trump's whole history goes back to his father, and his father connects back to Lucky Luciano, and that this is the key to understanding Trump's whole rise, that he was sort of whatever the kind of legacy of Lucky Luciano was basically propping up Trump and helping him to make all these deals in New York, and also protecting him from prosecution for his, you know, many different crimes and stuff like that. So I don't know if there's something to that, but it's certainly an avenue to explore, I would think.
And Operation Underworld, since I mentioned it, that was basically the code name for this cooperation that the United States government had with Italian and Jewish organized crime during World War II, where they were trying to sort of fight the Axis spies along the U.S.
Right,
northeastern
right.
seaboard ports. So, I mean, all, that stuff is proven. Even
yes.
like some of the MKUltra stuff is really fascinating. I mean, my favorite MKUltra thing is, have you ever heard of Operation Midnight Climax?
No, I don't think so.
Operation Midnight Climax was a part of MKUltra, where they were basically dosing people with LSD through these prostitutes. The prostitutes would give them LSD and have sex with them, and then they would talk to them after. And
oh yes,
people
okay.
were watching
yeah, I've heard
about this. In the
yeah.
peepholes to see what would happen. And I,
right.
you know, they must have a sense of humor to call it Operation Midnight Climax.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they were doing that in the Bay Area, right? In San Francisco?
Yes.
Because I
yes.
think that's connected in with the with what Tom O'Neill has reported in Chaos. So, yeah, that's pretty interesting. Yeah, one of the kind of MK Ultra LSD-related things that always sticks with me is that Paul Robeson was almost certainly poisoned with LSD. Or no, not LSD, with BZ. Which is more like a nerve agent, when he was doing a visit in Moscow. And they end up like he got very sick, and they end up spiriting him away to London to be treated by doctors that had connections to MKUltra programs. And they like electroshocked him like dozens of times or something. And he did survive all of it kind of amazingly. But it's one of those many, you know, one of those amazing stories that nobody knows about, because it's just too crazy to believe.
Well, the one everyone knows about now, I guess, is Frank Olson, because of that Netflix
sure,
series,
yeah.
Wormwood. Mm-hmm. Like, he jumped out a window, or he was helped. I mean, I could see him just jumping out the window because they dosed him with LSD, but, I mean, that's a crazy story in and of itself, and that's another where if the limited hangout is true, that's just as bad as the conspiracy.
Yeah, well, the crazy thing about Wormwood, and I do like the movie, and I know some people have criticized it for being a limited hangout and not telling the full story, but what I really like about that movie is the way that it shows how these limited hangouts work. They're walls that are set up, and you knock down one wall, and you think you've gotten to the truth, and then there's another wall in front of it. And so the original story was just like he had jumped out a window for some reason, and then it came out that he had been dosed with LSD and at a party, and he had basically gone insane, and they were watching him, and he just he jumped out the window because he was high on LSD or whatever, or his brain had gone insane. But the thing was, for one, it was like a few days after he had been dosed with LSD that he did fall out the window. And he was there with like two CIA handlers, I think they were. And anyway, the strong implication of that film, and I think of a lot of the theorizing on it, is that he was really just murdered and just pushed out of the window. And they had sort of covered it up with this kind of salacious MK Ultra story about acid, which was actually pushed, if I remember correctly, by Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This is in Wormwood, I'm pretty sure. And they, I believe, were the ones that were kind of the source of that story. And they had given some documents over to the family, but they were all kind of snippets, and they didn't, you had to kind of piece things together. And it was clear they were kind of leaving parts of the story out as well. And then the story ended up being reported by Seymour Hersh, who held on to the story for a long time, and Errol Morris confronts him in Wormwood, and he sort of goes back to his original source and finds that, yeah, probably it wasn't the story he thought it was. But then the way Hersh is, he's always very cagey about sources and, you know, I know things that I can't tell you. So he kind of claims to have found out the truth, but he won't really tell Errol Morris what it is. So I imagine that may be the source of some of the criticisms of the movie, that maybe there's more knowable information out there.
Yeah, Seymour Hersh is a character in and of himself with a lot of this stuff. I know I always love the story he's told. It's in one of his biographies where he was trying to cover Sidney Korshak, who was the subject of a really good book called Super Mob. Korshak was very involved with the mob in California, but he was also like a mover and shaker in L.A., just in general. Hersh has said, I tried covering Korshak, but, I backed off after a while, and that's when I realized I can cover as much as I want when it comes to, government malfeasance, but when it comes to the private sector, I'm just not doing that anymore. It's too much hassle.
Yes,
he's
exactly.
A very interesting guy. He leaves little tidbits.
He's very interesting, and it's been very curious to see how he's been, like, cast out of the mainstream recently and dismissed as completely a crazy conspiracy theorist. And he did come off a little bit weird to me when he was talking about Seth Rich and that whole story. And I have a feeling he got fed some bad information by one of his trusted sources, probably Larry Johnson, who's one of these ex-CIA guys who is involved with VIPs, and I have a feeling he got rolled a little bit by Larry Johnson, or possibly Larry Johnson got rolled by somebody else, but that was very weird. But yeah, the way that he can't even get published here now, and he's going to Die Welt in Germany and stuff to get anything out there is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I was going to say, as we begin to wrap up here, the other issue I sort of have, we were talking about Wormwood. And I mean, it makes a great story and all of that, and I get why people are fascinated by it. But like, as with Epstein, I almost feel bad for. I mean, I do feel bad for Erik Olsen, his mm-hmm. son, and I think people forget about. You know, a lot of people suffer because of this. Erik Olsen has been trying to get justice for his dad for years, and I mean, now we have the victims of Epstein seeking justice. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes that gets lost in the shovel. Maybe that's my other criticism of how conspiracy theories and parapolitics are handled at times.
I think that's really true. And one of the things that I thought might last year, I had this idea that that this was happening and it didn't happen, but that true crime, which is so popular now, you know, everywhere you go, there's true crime podcasts and movies, TV shows, documentaries, all this stuff. And Wormwood was basically a true crime story, and it framed it around Eric Olson investigating his dad's murder. And it was using this true crime format to kind of explore these wider conspiracies, or at least a hint at them. And then, you know, people can always go out and research their own thing. And so I thought that the true crime might be an avenue for balancing the victims and telling it from the victim's side of the story, while also being able to suggest this whole world of conspiracy that's going on, that it would be an avenue in. And one of the things that I thought was maybe going to do that kind of interestingly was that RFK Tapes podcast that was going around last year by the guys who did Crime Town. And it was very weird because it was like playing it up, kind of not exactly taking a view, but sort of laying out some of the ideas of why the official story of the RFK assassination is probably not true. And then it did a complete 180 about two episodes before it finished, started pouring water on the whole idea and saying it was crazy, even the stuff with, you know, bullet holes that is pretty well verified, saying it was just, you know, a cart crashing into the wall or something.
I mean, it's funny because even Vincent Bugliosi believed it was a conspiracy. And Vincent Bugliosi is the guy behind Helter Skelter and the guy who hated JFK assassination buffs.
Yeah, he hated him so much he wrote a 1,500-page gigantic book with CD footnotes that Jim DiEugenio claims to be probably the only person in the country who's ever actually read the entire thing.
Which is really weird because, like I said, he worked with Lisa Pease and Jim DiEugenio on some RFK stuff. It's weird.
Yeah. I don't know what to make of Bugliosi, and I think O'Neill's book, Chaos, will expose a lot of what maybe was going on internally with Bugliosi, because at least listening to interviews with him, the way he's talking is that Bugliosi basically was, you know, manipulated the entire Manson story and, you know, is not an above board figure at all. So I don't know. I don't know what to make of Bugliosi. He's a very strange, he's one of these strange guys out there.
Same with Errol Morris himself, the guy that did Wormwood.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
He's big against the JFK assassination stuff. I mean, He had a fight with Alexander, the guy who did the movie Repo Man. He had a fight with him over that. What's that?
Alex Cox.
Yeah, who's really big into the JFK assassination. They were sort of trading documentary barbs over it.
Yeah, well, he did a weird thing for, like, the New York Times about the woman with the umbrella at Dealey Plaza or whatever, kind of, like, debunking some tiny part of the conspiracy. And I don't know, it seemed to imply that, like, oh, well, the whole story is false because I've debunked this one little element of it. I don't know. And he's kind of tied in with Hirsch a little bit, too, because Hirsch is in Wormwood, and he had also done Standard Operating Procedure, which was about Abu Ghraib, and so Hirsch was involved in that, too. And Hirsch is a guy who's tries to pour water on the JFK assassination thing, too. So, I don't know. There are definitely people out there who maybe you just make your deal, and you're like, if I trade one JFK debunking thing, I get to do some other thing that I want to do. I don't know how it operates, but...
Well, I guess... Yeah, I just want to end this to go full circle again. What do you think the takeaway is going to be from Epstein, and also the effect that Epstein sort of has on conspiracy theory and how people view parapolitics? Because I'm amazed at the people who, after Epstein ended up dead, you know, we had people like Paul Krugman, who is pretty much as establishment as you can get, saying, well, you know, usually I don't like a paranoid view, but when you have people like Epstein around, you kind of have to be paranoid now.
Yeah, it's one of those stories that I think you can't help but form into a conspiracy. I mean, and I think the real question with Epstein, and what will determine his legacy, I think, to some extent, is what was he really doing? What actually was the nature of his entire operation? Was it simply that he was kind of like the pedophile pimp for the elites, or was he just servicing himself? I mean, those would be the most limited versions. Or it seems more likely he was involved in something broader. And was that blackmail, or was that some kind of elite clubby mentality where everybody's kind of in on the, you know, the abuse together? You know, was he the satanic pedophile of Ted Gunderson's imaginations? I don't know. I don't think we really know. I don't think we really know exactly what, how his connections to intelligence worked. I mean, one of the things that has not gotten maybe as much attention as I would expect is that he was identified as being an FBI asset when they did that plea deal in Florida that was so controversial. So we already know that he was, at least to some extent, and we have no idea to what extent, an intelligence asset for the U.S. government. And then he has connections to Ehud Barak and lots of people involved in Israeli intelligence, you know, potentially Robert Maxwell. So I think we just don't know. And in terms of the popular legacy, I think it will be seen as probably the most limited version of that, which is that he was a really skeezy guy who cozied up to lots of people in the mainstream, and maybe they did some things that would be illegal or at least heavily frowned upon, and he was taken out because he was a little bit too dangerous to them. So I think that's probably going to be the legacy, but I do have a feeling that there's a deeper level to his entire operation than we probably know or are likely to know anytime soon.
Well, it's just weird to me how people are even talking about Epstein, because to me, the Epstein saga, I've been calling it the sordid saga of Jeffrey Epstein, but it's not really just about Epstein. It never was just about Jeffrey Epstein. And I'm sort of annoyed with people who think that this is just about him. I mean, Les Wexner from Victoria's Secrets,
right?
You know, Jean-Luc Brunel of MC2 Modeling,
right.
Ghislaine Maxwell. These people are still out there. I mean, they were heavily involved with Epstein in, you know, ways that, you know, they were complicit. And to me, the fact that people just think this was about Epstein doesn't go far enough at all. And I think a lot of leads are going to go cold now because people aren't going to follow up on characters like the ones I just mentioned. And I think that's kind of sad.
Yeah, I think it's a tragedy. And I think you're right. I think maybe the best hope anybody has is that maybe Alan Dershowitz, some case will be brought against him because he seems to be completely flailing right now. But the idea that somebody like Jean-Luc Brunel, who there's a story, I believe Epstein's asked about this in his deposition from the Virginia Giuffre case, that Jean-Luc Brunel sent him 3 12-year-old girls for his birthday. To abuse from France. So, I mean, that incident alone, I mean, that's an obvious crime of sex trafficking and sexual abuse that you could prosecute Jean-Luc Brunel for if you were to pursue it, and assuming there's something there. But I don't have a lot of hope. I don't have a lot of hope that Jean-Luc Brunel will go down. I have very little hope that Ghislaine Maxwell really will go down. I don't think anybody even knows where she is right now.
Yeah, she fled the country like a few years
right.
back. She was in New York and then she just left. Last I heard is probably London, but
right. Which makes you wonder why Jeffrey Epstein was coming back to New York. I guess he just was so, you know, had such an ego or felt so protected that he felt like they're never going to come after him. I don't know. It just seems a little bit strange.
Well, the other side of this story that is not getting covered is no one's asking, barely anyone, I should say, is asking, how did this dude who grew up in a working class neighborhood, I believe in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
how exactly did this dude go from being, you know, a teacher that didn't even finish university to becoming really, really
right. Dropped out of two different
rich.
Colleges.
Yeah, he became really rich. He was involved with people that did pyramid schemes. No one is asking those questions either. And it's like, that's where I get really paranoid, because I'm like, no one is asking the right questions. No one's looking at the right leads. And it's just bizarre to me. I get why Ed Opperman is the private investigator, Ed Opperman, who I'm sure everyone knows listening to my show by now because I've had him on so many times. But I get why Ed Opperman is really annoyed with this case. because the mainstream media doesn't seem to get it, and a lot of the alternative media, so-called, doesn't seem to get it.
I think you're right. And to me, the origins are fascinating, and that's something I've tried to home in on a little bit. I mean, that's why I brought up earlier the point about the Dalton School, the point of clarification, because I think it is very important to know, how was he hired at that elite private school and why? How was he referred there? Who was the one who said, hey, you should apply here? Who's the one who hired him? And then from there, the story is that through a student he was friendly with, that student's parent worked for Bear Stearns, and everybody was just so bowled over at how brilliant Jeffrey Epstein is that you couldn't not hire him to work at your, you know, elite hedge fund agency, despite the fact that he had no, you know, paper qualifications to do that. Then he gets fired from Bear Stearns for a violation, some kind of insider trading violation, which nobody seems to have really looked into that specific detail all that much. And then starts his own private firm where there is, you know, one confirmed client, Les Wexner. That whole trajectory just from there, from the kind of mid-70s to the mid-80s, before really most of the allegations and connections creep up, makes no sense. I mean, that story, there is something there, and I would want to know what it is. And I think the fact if he was hired by Donald Barr, who is an OSS agent, I mean, I think that's relevant to perhaps unraveling some of the, you know, what was really going on there.
Well, hey, Gumby, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax to Use. Your Twitter has been, from what I understand, exploding lately. You know, I know the TruAnon podcast has been retweeting some of your stuff. I think Felix Biederman from Chaffo is aware of your work now. So I'm glad you're sort of dot connecting. It's getting out there.
Well, it's gotten to a point where I'm being trolled or psyoped in the strangest way lately, where I don't know if you saw this, but
I wanted to ask you about this before you we ended.
Because I don't know what to make of this. Let me see if I can pull it up real quick. But I got a direct message from somebody whose username was Alexandra Udinov, which I looked it up, and that's a character from the show Nikita, and I believe it's a Russian spy on the show Nikita. And they basically said something like, why are you going after Jeffrey Epstein so hard? He's a good man, and people like you drove him to suicide. Now, I mean, I've tweeted about Epstein a fair amount. I think other people have gone after him probably even harder than I have, so I don't know why exactly they were so fixated on me. So I don't know. I don't know what that is. I never thought I'd see an Epstein defender. And then the strangest thing about it is that it had all of this kind of fake Russian stuff going on with it, where all the accounts they followed were like RT and maybe Sputnik and Russia Insider. And it just a very bizarre thing. I do not know what to make of it.
I saw Russia Insider and RT were followed by this person, along with like Hugh Jackman for some reason. It's very odd.
That's who they were. Yeah, that's who they were following. They were following like 9 Russian media outlets: Hugh Jackman, Ryan Reynolds' gin company for some reason, and then me. And they decide to send me all these direct messages. So I found it here. So what they said was, people like you made Jeffrey Epstein kill himself. Spreading lies, you're fucking trash. So then I asked what lies, and this person replied, everything you post about him, you make him sound like some evil person. You and the media, it's innocent until proven guilty. Read a book and get off the internet for once. J.E. was a good person, you're fucked up for broadcasting anything else.
Was Alan Dershowitz yes, sliding into your DMs?
Maybe. Maybe he was. I don't know. And he's a big fan of Ryan Reynolds, too, I guess. So I don't know. I don't know what that's about. I don't know why they were following all these Russian accounts. One of the certainly probably the strangest thing that's happened to me on Twitter was that interaction.
Well, in closing, how can my listeners follow you on Twitter? And also, anything you would recommend people look into now in regards to parapolitics, any books that you should read. I'll recommend anything written by Peter Dale Scott people need to read. Even if they disagree with some of his analysis, he's really good. American War Machine in particular is a really great book. But anything you would recommend, and maybe how listeners can follow you on Twitter.
Sure. Well, my ridiculously named Twitter handle is Gumby4Christ. That's Gumby, the number 4, and then Christ. It's not a Christian account. That was just the stupidest name I could think of when I created the account. As far as books, I would definitely once again recommend Behind the Fog by Lisa Martino Taylor. I would absolutely second the recommendations for Peter Dale Scott. His work is incredible. I would, let's see, I didn't have anything off the top of my head. Dave McGowan is certainly a fun person to look into. I wouldn't trust every detail he has to say, but he will lead you in some avenues where if you're willing to figure out which parts are true and which parts are a little more tenuous, he'll send you in some interesting directions.
What was the book that he wrote, real quick?
He has a few. The one I've read all of is Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon.
That's the most famous one. And then he wrote Program to Kill, which is really out there stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, that is very out there. And he wrote one about fascism too, I think. The F Word, I think is the name of it. So those are all great books.
And listen to Mae Brussel and Dave Emery's archives.
Oh yeah, absolutely. They're incredible. Dave's still going. He goes in some strange directions sometimes and brings it all back to the Nazis with basically every subject. But he's
seem as crazy now, especially when you have I guess they found like missiles in this like Italian far right compound like 2 weeks ago.
Yes, it was like it felt like proof. Yes, Gladio is still happening, and the Reinhard Galen network is still in full force, and every conspiracy you think every conspiracy you've ever heard of is true. That's sort of how it's feeling right now, is that everything you would have dismissed as a lunatic conspiracy, it's all true, and it's all out there.
Well, hey, thanks again, Gumby, for coming on Parallax Views.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. Be sure to check out Gumby on Twitter at Gumby4Christ. He leaves a lot of interesting links. You can connect the dots with a lot of the stuff he posts. It's very interesting, like putting together a puzzle. And he lets you make up your own mind about stuff. Also, I'll be releasing another episode about conspiracy theories with Joseph Green that'll be available for my Patreon listeners. Got a collaboration coming up with the Antifada podcast on Gladio, which we mentioned during the conversation with Gumby. So lots to look forward to if you're a fan of Parallax Views. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.